Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode brought to you by Appeal, helping you to enjoy your fruits and vegetables at peak freshness and reduce food waste. Learn more at appeal.com, APEEL.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we dive into the science behind munchies, the history of coca, the therapeutic powers of psychedelics, and mushroom-infused recipes.
One of the biggest questions we get asked a lot is, does heat degrade psilocybin?
The coca leaf was used as a sacred plant. So as a plant that could communicate human beings with gods or Mother Nature.
What you can start to appreciate here is that cannabis is activating and hijacking the system throughout the body.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday. And, you know, most of the time we're pretty close to noon these days. And, you know, sometimes we go over. Nastasia might bump off if we go over because she hates it. She'll give you the book or goodbye. Speaking of which, we have from her undisclosed location somewhere in Southern California, Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We have John is back in his customer service hidey hole in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. How you doing, John? Yeah. We have Matt in his Rhode Island booth. We're doing the COVID. We're all over the map. How you doing?
Mm-hmm. Checking off an extra state for you.
Yeah, yeah. Rhode Island and Providence Plantation. And here, we don't know what state, but we have special guest, Melissa Weller, here today talking about her new book, A Good Bake, The Art and Science of Making Perfect Pastries, Cakes, Cookies, Pies, and Breads at Home. Well, welcome.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Where are you right now?
I'm still in the same place as always. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in Williamsburg.
Ah, nice. All right. Like, which part of Williamsburg? I mean, you don't have to say exactly. I'm not saying you have to, like, call out where
I don't mind. Anyone can know. It doesn't matter. I'm on Bedford Avenue, close to North 8th.
Jeez, what's up, fancy fans? Who's the fanciest person? You're the fanciest person in the whole world. Jeez.
I try.
You know, I used to work in that neighborhood in the like early to mid 90s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And a little bit different.
A little bit different. I've been in the same apartment for 16 years.
16 years. So what does that take you back to?
2004.
Okay, so 2004. All right. Okay, so... was Planet Thailand still existing back then?
It was. It had some kind of like swing chairs.
Yes. Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, like Williamsburg was kind of an industrial, it was like half industrial, half residential. There were still some old like kind of Polish places. There was a thrift store right off the subway where, you know, I used to go buy pants when I shredded my pants at the Brooklyn Brewery was over there, still is. I used to work for a famous sculptor named John Kessler, whose studio was over there. And so we used to go there. But like the restaurant that everyone was like, Planet Thailand, that was like the height of eating in Williamsburg. So, oh, Planet Thailand, oh, not Planet, it's like Plan Eat. Anyway, and then they were like a little hole in the wall. And then they went through a renovation and they got big and they had some sort of sculptural boat in the middle of their thing. And it was like the place. And then it just went away, right?
It's gone. I don't even know what's there now. I haven't actually been down that street for a little bit.
Yeah, and my memory gets blurred because it was so long ago. But I can't remember, was Kasha's Williamsburg or is that Greenpoint?
No, that was Williamsburg. I think that was Williamsburg.
Is that also gone?
It's not there anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And the thrift store's gone.
The thrift store is a Chase Bank now.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
This reminds me, did you guys see that, like, a couple of days ago, Bob Dylan sold his entire song catalog for $300 million?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I can't wait till like Chase Bank has Bob Dylan songs for their thing or whatever kind of cash grab, yeah. like lunacy. And the thing is, the guy is still alive. He's going to have to turn off his TV and like turn off the internet.
Oh, wow.
So that he doesn't see. I mean, it's only a matter of time before there's like a G.I. Joe tambourine man. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
No, no, no. Every time he sees that, he's just going to be like, that is the sound of money.
That's the sound of money. Yeah, so like the idea that that thrift store, which was not a bad thrift store, by the way, it was pretty good.
I donated many things to it.
Yeah, and it was right there, and it was an old school one, so like it wasn't like wasn't one of these thrift stores where you walk in and you're like, oh, that sweat is nice, $50, what? No, it was like a thrift store, and like you could get like if you needed a pie plate. Because how many of you, okay, let's get into this for a second before we get into the book. Melissa, how many times this it doesn't happen to you because you specify glass pie plates, right?
Oh, so I'm sure.
Well, we'll talk about this. But I'm sure, because like whenever I take a pie to someone's house, basically they get to keep the pie plate. So I can't go through glass like that.
That's true. That's true. Although I do use aluminum like in a bakery, so I don't have to worry about that too.
Do you use black aluminum or do you use the regular silvered aluminum?
The silver aluminum that you can buy at a bodega.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it's fine. If you know how to bake with it, it's fine. But, you know, for home, if you want to be perfect, get a glass plate.
Like dimples and everything? Like a Greek salad tin? Or do they make one specially for pies?
They make one specially for pies.
All right.
Okay. Yeah.
So, like, how do you... So for those of you that, like, don't think about cheat trays or whatnot, you have to adjust how you bake to the stuff that you're using. So if you use something shiny, it affects very much like how brown the product is going to get because you're reflecting away all the radiant heat from the oven. So how do you compensate if you're going to use glass, which although it takes a while to heat up, is fairly good at absorbing radiant heat. So, you know, that's going to give you a particular kind of brownness on the bottom of the crust. How do you adjust when you're switching to shiny disposable aluminums for your dirtbag buddies?
Yeah, I think I use those aluminum tins primarily at work. So I have a convection oven. So the bake time's different in the convection oven than it is at home. So actually, I'd have to think, I think I probably bake them about the same length of time, same amount of time in the convection oven with the aluminum. But then that gets a little bit more complicated because when I'm baking pies for work, I actually make a large batch of pies and then I freeze them all. And so I'm baking them from frozen in an aluminum tin versus just one pie in a glass pie plate at home.
Hmm. So you're saying it's like not instantly mentally translatable, like what
the, I don't think so I can many do differences. That. Yeah, I can't do that right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, for those out there that are not familiar with Melissa's work, by the way, we have like so much like almost overlap in our lives. It's crazy.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, yeah. Exactly. I was thinking about the French Culinary Institute. I think we were almost there at the same time.
I came on probably right after you graduated. Well, let's go through
some
people. So first of all, you started as a chemical engineer in Pennsylvania. You're from Pennsylvania, right?
Correct. Yes, I did. And I started work as an engineer in Pennsylvania.
What kind of Pennsylvania are you from? Are you like an Eastern or Western Pennsylvania person?
I'm central, Clearfield County, Clearfield, central, west of State College.
Okay. All right. But then you went to work like literally as a chemical engineer in Allentown where they were shutting all the factories down. It's getting very hard to stay.
Exactly.
Well, what were you chemically engineering? What was your specialty?
Hydrogen and carbon monoxide plants for petroleum refining.
Whoa. I didn't know that was a big business in Allentown. I always think of that as like Elizabeth or like, you know, closer to the coast. They did a lot of refining stuff over there.
It wasn't there wasn't refining happening at, it was at Air Products. So there wasn't refining happening there, but all of the design was happening there. And then all of the plants were located around the world. So I traveled to Houston a lot that year, the year I graduated from college. I was going to Houston all the time. And once I went to Korea and another time I went to Puerto Rico, it's just all over the place.
You know who else has an Allentown connection or almost Easton connection is Nastasia.
Oh,
my
really?
Mom was born there. Well, my mom lived there, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why Nastasia will never buy an off-brand crayon, only Crayola. All right, so then you move from there to San Diego, And that's when you decide, like, crap on this chemical engineering stuff. Like, you weren't down with it anymore. Like, what was the career change like? Because I think we had a lot of career changes.
It took a while, actually. I actually moved to Berkeley, to San Francisco, and I got a job in, I got a couple of jobs in the front of the house at different restaurants in San Francisco. And I tried to make that work. And that lasted for a few months. And then I got cold feet. And I started to look for an engineering job, and that took me to San Diego. And I worked as an engineer in San Diego for a couple of years, and I just didn't like it, obviously. And I wanted to do something more. I wanted to do cooking, and I wanted to be creative. And so it was in San Diego that I started volunteering to work at this nice fine dining restaurant. It's a very small restaurant, and they needed somebody to do pastry. So that's what I did.
Now, were you, this is so funny, I don't think I've mentioned this on the air before, but I was, when I graduated from college, I was a paralegal. I was the world's worst paralegal. And I was like, to hell with this, because at home, like, I was baking bread all the time was what I was doing for fun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is in like 93 and okay. 94. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of information. There wasn't the internet. I wasn't very good at it. That's not the point. But, like, yeah. There was a bakery in New Haven because, you know, we stayed in town after we graduated because my wife had, like, a really good job at – I mean, she wasn't my wife at the time. She was my girlfriend. But she was working for Cesar Pelli's, who's a great architect. Anyway, so, like, I had to stay in town. I was a crappy – crap, I was so bad at being a paralegal. I'm just not good at it.
I think I was awful at being an engineer. I hated my job. I had to spec out safety valves for these large plants, and I hated it. I just don't think I was good at it.
I mean, you got to be careful, you know?
Yeah, you have to be very careful. My first job was as a safety engineer.
Yeah, well, that's an important job.
Yeah, yeah. You had to figure out if the safety relief valve released, how far and in what direction would the carbon monoxide plume vent into the atmosphere? Mm. And I had to go through all of these parameters to make sure that the valve was placed in the right angle.
That makes me feel
comfortable that the entry level position for engineers is a safety engineer.
Hey, look.
Throw the new guy at this. Yeah, all right.
Just because she was entry level doesn't mean she wasn't skilled at it. Matt,
I didn't like it, but I was good at my job. I'm pretty self critical, but I remember we had to be reviewed, and I thought I did a horrible job, and my boss is like, "Why are you being so hard on yourself? You did fine." I think that's the sort of the story of my life.
Real quick, I threatened to leave my job and become a baker, and I had it all lined up. I was going to go work, but the thing is, I couldn't get up at 5 a.m. You know what I mean? Like, and I ended up doing database design instead, and that's how I paid to become the person that I am for those people. But yeah, I came like within like a hair's breadth close of like saying crap on it and going to work for who is the best, you know, the best bakery in New Haven at the time.
Oh, yeah. That's so similar to me, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but did you have to do it at, like, 4 a.m., or were you able to work, like, normal pastry people at, like, hours? What were you doing?
I didn't. Well, I think it's easier for me to wake up early. I'm not very good at staying up late. And so some of the jobs, I think the first job that I had in the restaurant industry in San Francisco was at Rubicon. And it was a hostess job, and it wasn't early or late. It just required people skills and being friendly to people. And it's not that I'm not friendly to people. I'm a little bit introverted, but it wasn't a great fit at all. And it was like I hardly made any money, and I was just like, what am I doing? And I got cold feet, and I quickly moved back into engineering.
Yeah, host is so tough. It's so tough. You just don't make any. That's why, like, you know, when it's the owner, like the owner FOH does it, like, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But, like, you just don't make a lot of money. You have to look really presentable. You're the first thing people see when they show up. You have to be nice to people. You get all the abuse from the person that can't get the table, and you just don't make that much money. And you're the first person cut in the FOH. It's crazy. I don't understand it. I have a lot of respect for people doing the host job, you know?
Yeah, it was. And I think, you know, I think when I started, I was like, well, I just want to take a job and work my way up, and I want to learn about how restaurants work. But I would have taken a server job. I just had no skill set at that time. And the host is the job that's like the entry level front of the house job, or was at the time. That was the only thing I could get. And It was pretty miserable. That's mostly what I remember. I remember carrying platters of drinks to people's table if they were at the bar and I had to move their drinks to the dining room. And I mean, for me, that was super stressful. I'm like, I'm going to spill the drinks. Now I think it's sort of, I can't believe, you know, well, now is now. But back then, that was like in the 90s. That was in the late 90s. That was pretty stressful. And I just didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't blame you. So then you decide you're gonna go to culinary school, and you ended up in New York at my old institution, the French Culinary. You did the pastry program, right?
Yeah, I did. I was there in 2004. Yeah, I did the pastry program. I loved it.
Yeah, it's such a that like in 2004. So I came on at the end of 2004. That school is really firing on all cylinders, man. The chefs there were so good. Like, who did you have for pastry? Do you remember?
I had Toni Lynn Dickinson. She was amazing. And Kier Rodriguez, too.
Awesome. Love Kier.
They were a team, actually. He had just started, and so they worked together. And I loved it so much. I learned so much from both of them.
Chef Kier, ex-monk.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're great. It's such a shame what happened. They're closing down. The official end of the program is in December. I'm probably going to go one more time because the museum, like they donated their library to the museum. And guess what else Museum of Food and Drink has? We have all the old DVDs of all of the old demos.
Oh wow! Yeah. I used to love those demos. I remember Jacques Pépin. He did so many amazing demos there. I was really drawn to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the guy is, what is he, like a million? What is he? He's like a head in a Futurama jar at this point. I think he can still bone a chicken in like 17 seconds or something like
this. Yeah.
But anyway, the FCI was, all right. So you go from there, and then did you go directly to Babbo from there?
No, I had a little job in between. I was working at Chelsea Market at this patisserie called Goupil and DiCarlo, and I was making croissants there. And that wasn't a good fit for me. And it lasted for a few months. And then I started looking for like the right job. And I really wanted to work in a bakery. But at that time in 2004 and early 2005, there weren't a lot of good bakeries to choose from in New York. And so I was reluctant to take a restaurant job, but I really wanted to work with Gina De Palma. And Babbo was such a happening restaurant at that time that when I saw the job opening there, I'm like, I really want to do this job. Even if it's not at a bakery, I'll learn a lot. And it opened up so many doors for me. I worked so hard in that job. And as a result, the doors just opened. And Gina, my mentor, just, you know, helped me get whatever job I wanted afterwards.
Now, she used to come back and do demos and events at the FCI a lot. Did you meet her there? Like when she was doing a demo or something?
I met her when I trailed for the job at Babbo. I hadn't met her before, but I was familiar with her work. And I went to eat. I went to Babbo before my trail so I could try the desserts. And I used to do that at a lot of different places back then. It's just go sit at the bar and order dessert so I could see what different chefs were doing. And I really loved, she was very classical, but she was also employing a lot of savory ingredients. And that was new at that time. There weren't that many chefs who were doing that. And I was really drawn to that. And so I trailed with her and we just hit it off. And I just started working there right away pretty much.
Yeah. For those of you that aren't familiar, Gina De Palma was among pastry chefs, just like a revered figure. Like everyone always kind of got the opinion that somehow she always, even though she was well known, she always managed to get like a little bit snubbed by by, I don't know, awards and whatever else. I mean, it's not that she wasn't recognized, but everyone who knew her work always kind of felt that she was getting a little bit snubbed. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. That was absolutely the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't until her cookbook came out that she finally got the recognition that she deserved.
Yeah. And she was around in the era of the famous pastry chef. So like, again, for people who don't, you know, remember, like from about 2001 or two to about 2008 was like the decade of the pastry chef, really. Like they were like, you know, in terms of public awareness.
Yeah, you're right about that. No, that's so true. She was Claudia Fleming's sous chef at Gramercy Tavern.
Who you also call out her book as being an influence for you.
Yes, no, exactly. And I think I think knowing that Gina had worked for Claudia was a big factor in wanting to work for Gina.
Yeah, and I only knew her tangentially. Like I met her a couple of times, Gina. You know, she, you know, tragically got sick with cancer, died, you know, very, very young, and like continued to work while she was sick, right? It was crazy, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was. Yeah, no, I think she was diagnosed with cancer in 2008, and then she passed away in 2015. And for most of that entire time, she was working.
Yeah, yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts. Anyway, so go look up her work, check out her work. Pastries, she's universally revered in the field at the time while she was working. Universally. Wouldn't you say that's true or no?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So then from Babbo, you go to work with everybody's favorite bread lunatic, Jim Leahy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very apropos.
Yeah, I mean, what a nutbag, right?
Yeah, he's crazy, but I think that's part of what makes his bread does his bread good.
Yeah, yeah. Nastasia almost worked with him, almost took a full-time job with him. She was deciding between working with us at the French Culinary or with him over at Sullivan up at the 50. Were you up in the 50th
Street? Yeah, 47th Street,
Yeah. And she unwisely chose to come to the FCI, right, Stas?
I was working with him. I was his co-mee at the opening of Co. on 24th Street.
Okay.
You overlapped for like a couple of months?
Yeah. Remember? We go back and forth.
What a nut. Anyway, whenever he comes on the show, he like invariably curses a blue streak. And we shared an editor. If you ever want to see, what you want to do is Maria Guarnaschelli, who is.
Yes, that was Gina's editor too, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
If I ever get to speak to Maria again, I'll have to ask about that. But like, if Nastasia, Maria loves Nastasia, like loves her. I think she signed me so that she could have lunch with Nastasia on a regular basis. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So Maria Guarnaschelli was one of the great editors, cookbook editors of all time. All right. Just so if you don't know who she is, that's who she is. And her daughter is Alex Guarnaschelli, well-known chef. But she always scared the daylights out of me, Maria.
Yeah.
Did. Like scared the hell out of me. And one of like Nastasia's favorite things to do is we'd get Maria in a room talking about Jim Leahy, and then like the next day we would get Jim Leahy in a room talking about Maria. That is a fun game.
Oh my god, Stas? Can I be present the next time? I want to be part of that.
I mean, I don't know if those times will ever be recreated.
No, that's true. No, it's true. Yeah, probably not. I met Maria at a food writing conference. Back in 2001 in Napa. I think that's as long as I've wanted to write a cookbook. I went to a food writing conference back then and I met her there. I introduced myself. I knew who she was. I used to read the acknowledgments in all of the cookbooks that I was reading. So I knew who she was and I just introduced myself and that was pretty much it. But then I actually met her basically the second day I started working for Gina. So I knew her from Gina and she never ever remembered me. I kept running into her and I'd be like, she was sort of like a superstar to me. Cause I really wanted to write a cookbook and I'd be like, there's Maria. And so I knew her through Gina, but she never remembered me. And then I knew that she was doing Jim's book. And I was working for Jim when he was working on his book with Maria, which is sort of ironic. And then I think I ran into her when I was working at Roberta, she was having a lunch. And finally I told her again who I was and I'm like, do you remember me? And I don't think she remembered me, but she was so flattered that she sent me a cookbook.
That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah.
Well, she ate at Roberta's when Nastasia and I were talking with her because I think that was when Roberta's was trying to pitch their book out to different publishing houses.
Oh, wow. Okay, so then I was there making the bread at that time.
Yeah. All right, so speaking of Leahy, while we're on the subject, one of the recipes in the book is inspired kind of by the no-knead stuff, so might as well knock that out while we're talking
So
instead of water, you use carrot juice in it, right? It's carrots, currants, pecan bread, and it's a classic. It's in a Dutch oven, very high hydration.
Yes.
But so I wanted to like mention, so you talk about it for a second. One of the interesting things to me about it are, one, it's even higher hydration than Leahy's like standard mix, and you also call for bread flour instead of AP, and I'm wondering, A, is that why you have the higher hydration? And then you also use like rye flour on the outside as your dust. How messy is that sucker to flip? You want to talk about that recipe for a second? Oh, and last, it's got different size air holes in the standard Leahy, so it's not as, and I wondered whether it was the ingredients that did that. It's not as one tiny bubble, one giant bubble as a lot of his stuff. It's more like a normal bread crumb, so go.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So let's talk about this bread. So it's with carrot juice, and it's not sweet. It's a savory bread. And I helped Jim with all of his, when I was working for Jim, I would help him with his bread classes, and he was teaching no-knead bread classes, and he was all of the bread dough that we made at the bakery was no-knead bread dough that we would bulk ferment for 9 hours at a time. And I was helping him with his classes, and he was working on the recipes for his cookbook. And this is a version of a recipe that he had done, and I loved it. All of Jim's flours at that time were coming from a silo, and so it was like one type of flour. And I just think over the years I've just adapted to flours that work. I think that work best for, like, I think bread flour, it takes a little bit longer for the gluten to break down with bread flour. I thought that worked better for this. I generally try to use, well, no, that's not true. I'm very specific about my flours, but I did think that the bread flour worked best for this dough. It wasn't sort of as like wet, if you will, as like a, like if you used all-purpose flour. I use all-purpose flour. I use King Arthur all-purpose flour. That's a pretty, King Arthur all-purpose flour has a pretty high percentage protein content. I think it's more like 12.9, which is it 12 or no, 11.9. So it's almost 12%. That's almost like bread flour. And I think Jim always used bran, wheat bran for everything. And I like wheat bran. I think regardless of what you do with no-knead bread, if it involves flipping and flour or bran, you're going to have a little bit of a mess in your kitchen. And I try to keep things simple and not have too many ingredients going on. I feel the same about sourdough starters. I don't try to have six different starters. I try to keep it to just like one, maybe two.
Even professionally.
I've had to deal with having all of these different sourdough starters professionally. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of labor. It causes a lot of, it's difficult for the bakery to maintain all of those. And so I generally try to like wheedle them down to one liquid starter based on wheat flour and maybe a rye starter and then a poulish generally. And so for this dough, I have to say, I love the photo in my book of the carrot bread's beautiful, but man, that bread over fermented for me that day because I was trying to get all of the products ready for a photo shoot and also work. I was at High Street, so I was also in charge of the production at High Street. And I remember that day, I was like, oh my God, it over fermented. Is it going to be okay? And the crumb's really beautiful, but I was a little nervous. It wasn't as like, his bread definitely has some big holes and some little holes. And if you do the regular white bread, if you will, no-knead bread, you do get that variation. But I also think that there is, and I'm just guessing here, that there's residual sugar in the carrot juice that's causing it to ferment a little faster. And it would be more responsible for, and also I'm going all over the place, sort of jumping all over the place, but I also think that the higher hydration also, is that true? See, I have to think through, I want to think through it. The higher the hydration, if you have a strong, if you have the right flour and a strong flour, it should be able to handle that. But I actually think that I probably fermented it a little bit too long that day. But proofed it too long.
Right. So you think that normally it would have like a little more of that big hole, little hole thing?
Yeah, I think normally it would. Yeah.
I mean, like, by the way, I like all kinds of breadcrumbs. Like, I know people go, like, crazy. They want one specific thing.
Yeah.
As long as someone can control it and make it taste good, I mean, I'm for it. You know
what I mean? I think that's the most important thing. It has to taste good. It has to look, I think it needs to have this, like, pretty, like, a beautiful rusticity to it is good. But the most important thing is how it tastes.
Yeah. Speaking of which, well, we'll get to it later. So then after Leahy, you go to work for a different kind of crazy. You go to Per Se.
Yeah, that's definitely a different kind of crazy.
I mean, one of the favorite people that Nastassi and I worked with at FCI went to go work for Per Se, and we're like, dude, you nuts? I mean, that's crazy, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. It was so hard. I can't even begin to describe how challenging it was. I learned so much. I'm so grateful for that experience, but it was really hard.
Yeah, and plus, what was it like working in that space in the Time Warner building? I mean, that's just the whole thing. It's like, imagine being in that kind of a kitchen, but also like in that, like, location. It seems like all kind of crazy, right? Or not?
It was hard. I felt like the products felt like where we were. I don't know if that makes sense, but it felt very, the Time Warner Center is a bit like a shopping mall, and I felt like everything is on display. Everything's perfect. Everything looks perfect. And I felt like that's how my breads were too. They were on display. I was on display while I worked, and everything had to look perfect. And generally it tasted good too.
Right. Yeah, no, but like, and it's so weird because you're in that area of like hyper control inside of Per Se, but then outside at the bakery, you're selling to people eating at cafe tables in a mall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just interesting.
Yeah, it was hard.
So then, you were the head baker there, right?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
And then you went from there to Roberta's. Oh my God, what are you like?
I'm probably pretty crazy. You know what? I feel like I'm pretty ambitious with my career, and this opportunity at Per Se to be the head baker came up, and I have to say I had hardly any experience baking bread and managing a team at the time that I was hired. Like, I had only been working, I was hired in 2008. I started working at Babbo in 2005. That's only 3 years, and I only worked at Sullivan for 1 year, and they needed somebody who understood bread and understood fine dining and had that skill set. And I had a good tasting. I presented myself well, neat and tidy. And I was hired, but I wasn't prepared to manage even a small team at Per Se. There was so much pressure on my shoulders, and it was a big learning curve for me. It was hard, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity. But then I was pregnant. I got pregnant while I was at Per Se, and I wasn't sure how I was going to handle my pregnancy, but I did leave Per Se and I took time off because I don't think it would have been realistic at all to have had a baby and continued to work as a head baker at Per Se. I just don't see how it could have worked. I was working like 14-hour days, not taking, it was lucky if I had a day off a week. And I don't know how you can divide your time between you can't have it all. I don't think you could have that job, that particular job, and have a newborn. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was pretty burned out. And I was like, well, I'm burned out, but I still really want to make the kind of bread that I want to make. And right around that time, I got an email or a text message from a friend of mine saying that Roberta's was looking for a head baker. And that was appealing to me because I live in Williamsburg and it's not that far away. So, and they didn't care what I did. Honestly.
That checks out. That checks out.
Yeah, they said, we don't care what you do. We just need you to sell some bread. Just make some bread for the restaurant. We don't care. And I was like, okay, well, this is like my free card to do whatever I want. And I can create my own schedule around my child. And that was really like one of the most important things for me at that time was to create a schedule so I could be home as much as I could to take care of my son. And so I stayed there it's a different kind of crazy. Per Se was crazy. Everywhere is crazy in the restaurant industry in New York, I think, sometimes. But Roberta's was definitely a different kind of crazy. But I also You know, I also got to start to make my own fangs. I don't feel like anything that I made at Per Se was, it's not true. I mean, I did make my own breads there, but really something that reflected me, I feel like that was what happened at Roberta's, was the products that the bakery items that I was making really reflected me.
So you think like Roberta's at its best, like as a concept. And so like, you know, I don't know, like I'm always with Nastassia at Roberta's, and especially because we've been going for how many years, Stas?
Over 10.
How many years? We 10 something years? Yeah.
Oh, wow,
and
yeah.
We're like, how is this possible? Right? It's like, how are they not getting, like they're not following any rules. How are they not getting shut down, et cetera, et cetera? How are they able to just like do all this stuff that doesn't make any sense, like in terms of, you know, if it makes sense from an outsider perspective, but if you're, you know, even like tangentially involved in the business, you look at it, you're like, how are they doing this and not getting like smacked around by the authorities that be or whatnot? But you're, but at its best, it really, you think, allowed you to kind of be who you were? Like their lack of rules allowed you to be who you wanted to be? That's nice.
Yeah. At the time, I was baking in a wood-fired oven that was outside in a shipping container. And that's pretty illegal as far as I can tell. Like no one was monitoring that oven. It was just sort of out there, and we'd build a fire in it. And then I'd go out in the early morning and clean it out and bake some bread in it. And I remember we'd be careful, you know, like it's in the yard. This sounds awful to say, but the DOH would come by, but they would come by to Roberta's and not to the yard.
Huh.
And I think that that was sort of part of it at the time. But, you know, the rent was so low there. It was just incredible. I still remember seeing the numbers, just incredible how low it was, that it made so many things possible because the rent was so low.
Well, didn't they, Nastassia, like redesign the entire courtyard to take advantage of a fancy pigeon that had like decided it was going to live in that yard?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
It seemed like that. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, man. No, I would believe it. I believe it. Maybe I was I still there at that time? I'm not sure.
That fancy pigeon. It was a very fancy pigeon. I will have to say the pigeon was extremely fancy. So then you hooked up with Major Food Group and did Siddell's, huh?
Yeah.
Do you know, I still haven't been because I know that I will bankrupt myself on salmon if I go.
Oh, that's true.
Nastassia's been several times.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. So yeah. I was ready to leave Roberta's. So, you know, I'm a career changer. So I just remember I had just turned 40 and it was New Year's Day. It was like 2 a.m. on New Year's Day. And I was like dealing with a lot of people who were still at Roberta's partying. I was just trying to get my bake done. And I'm like, I'm sort of done with this. I'm done with this. I said, I'm a grown up now. I'm done. I need to leave. I need to get my own business started. And so my idea was at the time was I'm going to sell bagels at the Williamsburg Smorgasburg while I work on a business plan. And I knew that the bagels were a good idea, but I didn't know how they would catch on. And I just thought it was, this is a good idea. People want something small that they can take away at the Smorgasburg. And, you know, at that point, New York Magazine, Robin Raisfeld and Rob Patronite were fans of Roberta's.
Great people, by the way. Great people.
Yeah, I love them so much. And they were the first ones to really write about my stuff. And they picked up that I was at the Smorgasburg and they went with it and they included it in their magazine. And it was through that article in the magazine that I was connected to an investor for the Major Food Group who connected me to the Major Food Group partners. And I dropped some bagels and sticky buns off to them. They were sold. And we agreed to partner. I thought partnering with them was a good idea at the time. And so we partnered in 2013. And we spent 2 years designing and recipe testing Siddell's, and we opened it up in the fall of 2015.
Yeah. So I have to say this. So for those of you that don't know, like Major Food Group is like Carbone, Terese, all of this, and anything they take on kind of in a big way.
Yeah.
And this was like their, you know, your and their take on kind of like what would it, you know, kind of like deli on crack, right? I mean, like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And but it, like the other thing is strange is that it was kind of like all your stuff in the daytime and then a different restaurant at night, right?
Yeah, it was. It was like it was like a New York deli with bagels and lox during the day, and at night it was this Russian restaurant that it never really caught on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because you know what people like, they like bagels and lox, it turns out.
It's true.
I don't know whether you know this, but you know, so now we have to get down to bagels. We're going to have a little bit of a bagel thing. I read through this book twice.
Yeah.
I looked in the index.
Yep. No bagels.
No bagels.
That's
Are you contractually obligated to not write a bagel recipe?
Oh, I held back on the bagels. They're in book number two.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
Because you do have boiled doughs. You do pretzels.
Yeah. No, the bagels are so, there's so much for me to say about bagels. And to me, bagels are really savory. And I wanted to include more savory recipes with the bagels that they didn't feel like they belonged in this book. This book's more sweet. It's got sweet cookies, pies, laminated pastries. And I just felt like bagels deserve their own book. So they're not in this book.
You have like, you know, you have some savory stuff in this book, though.
I do. But not the way that I felt that bagels, otherwise it'd be like a 1,000-page book.
So you're going to do like a bagel-only book for book two?
Book two is going to be bread, and bagels are bread, by the way.
So
there will be really sourdough bread, baguettes, bagels, like things that are like really more bread baker focused to bake at home. And I'll probably do some fun sandwiches too, but not really sweet things.
Hmm. So now on bagels, you, I gather, are not a fan of the SS-style puffy bagel.
No.
You don't want to make it yourself. I'm not saying you hate them, but that's not what you're interested in making. Let's put it that way.
I want to make good bagels that are true to New York.
Well, but at this point, S has been around since what? I mean, at this point, it is a New York style.
That's true. I'm looking at, that's true.
You know, I mean, like, I get what you're saying. And like a lot of the old, like, who do you like, other than your own stuff, who do you like in the city?
I like Absolute Bagels.
Oh, what's up? Like, do you ever live up there?
No, I've got people bringing them down to me.
But the thing is, Absolute, those guys started at Essa. They changed
their stuff. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Unless I'm getting confused.
No, I believe you. Yeah, that makes sense.
They're run by a Thai family, right?
Yes, they are. I've been getting their bagels and sort of looking at them, and I've been thinking about my own bagels, and I'm working at Gertie right now, by the way, and we're working on a bagel recipe, and I'm excited about it because I wanted to change my bagel recipe a little bit and make it a little bit more. You know, what happened was I was making the bagels at Sedell's, and then I also made them at High Street on Hudson. And the owner of Bubby's came in. He had read an article about me being at High Street, and he had my bagels, and he started telling me about, he grew up in the city, and he was telling me what bagels were like in like the 70s or 80s, and how it was just, he used to just get this bag of like really hot, doughy-like bagels. And he was just talking about how doughy they were. And I was really intrigued by what he said. I'm like, you know, I really love food culture and food history. And I was like, I'm really intrigued by this, but you know, my bagels aren't like that. I like my bagels, but I'm wondering if I change them, how would I change them? Would I try to make them more like those bagels you'd get in before they got really oversized, but like maybe they'd be like bagels from like the 80s size wise, but have flavor to them. And so I've been thinking about that lately, trying to make them more like
bagels.
New York bagels.
Yeah. I mean, the 80s puffy bagels, as I remember them, a lot of them were like a little bit sallow and not just puffy, but like doughy in the gummy sense.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. It's how are you baking the bagel? And I know bagels are trendy to bake right now with bread bakers, but like how our bagels are not supposed to be baked like a loaf of bread, actually, because people don't want an artisanal thick crust on them. I feel the same about a baguette, actually, because those are such a thin piece of bread that if you try to achieve a really thick crust on them, like a bread baker would an artisanal loaf of sourdough, it's too thick. You're going to tear your teeth out. And then that's not what people want out of a bagel. They want something squishy and they want some doughiness. It's just how much doughiness is the right amount of doughiness.
But do you like blistering on a bagel crust or no?
I do, but it really depends on the type of oven that you're baking it out of.
What are your thoughts on the... Go.
Well, you know, I get blisters if I bake it in a convection oven really pretty easily. I don't get blisters when I bake it in a bagel oven. It's the way the dough is moving through the chamber. And I know that those are both types of convection, but there is a difference, and I don't get blisters in a bagel oven. So I think it depends on the oven that you're using. Like if you're
What do they bake bagels on? Rotary decks?
They bake them on rotary decks, exactly. So the deck goes around like a Ferris wheel. And it has this like heat source at the bottom of the oven down near the bottom, like any home oven would. And then the bagels just rotate on this deck until they're baked. And what I thought was really interesting, because I did so much testing of bagels. In a convection oven, a Blodgett, because that's what I had. But then when I switched over to this revolving tray oven, the bagels got really pale. They got shiny. They were shiny and pale. They weren't taking on color just because of the way they were moving around in the oven. And then I would bring the bagels around to different bagel shops. And this is with Sidell's, some R&D before we opened. And I would bake the bagels in their ovens and I'd use their kettles of water. And every bakery was offering me to add sugar to the water, to some type of sweetener to the water, whether it's like barley malt syrup or brown sugar. Everyone had their own concoction. I'm like, oh, well, this is to brown it up. Exactly. I was like, this is pretty fascinating. There's no other reason except to cause some browning. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Huh. It is interesting.
Yeah.
So like all the people who freak out that you need malt, it's just any reducing sugar in that water is gonna do the browning for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the Montreal style of bagel? This is
I like the size. I like, you know what? I love when the sesame seeds hit the wood-fired oven and they're toasted on the bottoms and the tops. I really think that's cool. I think I like the flavor there. I wish that they had more salt in the dough. And I don't necessarily like how they're, if I remember, the ones that I've had are a little sweet, maybe a little too sweet for me. But I like the size.
What's with the lack of salt? Have you ever had anyone accurately describe why they do that? Or is it just they're ornery?
I think it's just the way, I think it's the way the recipe developed there. And I think a lot of maybe I have too much of a salted palate at this point, because if I go to Europe, when I was going to France and eating in France, I was noticing, I'm like, wow, like my palate's really salty. I need more salt in a lot of things that I used to not need. And if you look at old recipes for like pastries, there's no salt. Salt's sort of a new thing. I feel like more salt being added to baked goods is a newer thing. And I just think it's the history of how salt came to be in the Montreal bagels, or there was no salt in the bagels. Whomever started making them just didn't make them with salt.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes progress is progress. Salt is a good thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Speaking of progress, you say that you've switched out of cornstarch for the vast majority are using arrowroot. You really think it's worth the extra money?
I like it.
It's not that much money, I guess. I guess it's not that much more money.
Yeah, I don't think I use that much arrowroot. It lasts a long time. Ditto for the cornstarch. Like, I'm not using those all the time. So,
because you're not a fan of the cornstarch swap in a flour recipe.
I do use cornstarch, but I think for the most part, if I can swap it out or try to swap it out, I'll swap it out.
Yeah.
You really read my book. I like that.
Yeah. This episode brought to you by Appeal. Here at HRN, we care about reducing waste across our food system, from farms to home kitchens. We know that about half of the produce we grow ends up in the trash. We all want to enjoy produce at peak freshness and reduce the amount that gets thrown away. That's where Appeal comes in. Appeal is a plant-based protective layer that helps produce last up to twice as long. It's edible, invisible, and imitates how peels naturally protect fruits and vegetables. Because here's the thing, less waste doesn't just mean that we're throwing less food away, it also means we throw away less water, energy, and other resources that go into growing produce. Appeal works with nature to reduce waste across the food system, from the farm to the kitchen. Appeal helps us to conserve our precious resources to ensure that we have fresh food to meet our growing needs. Appeal, food gone good. Learn more at appeal.com.
Chad had a question about ultra-low sodium diets. Any suggestions for baking for people on ultra-low sodium diets, bread in particular, but also other items? Salt is so vital for so many formulas, and I haven't found much way around it.
I remember at when I worked at Per Se, we had to accommodate every diet, and I remember I had a saltless bread. I think that you can, you know, you're not going to get the same thing. You can totally reduce the amount of salt or maybe take it all out, and you're not going to get the same product, and the bake isn't going to be the same, and the browning isn't going to be the same. But that's not to say that you can't make a good loaf of bread without salt. And I remember at Sullivan Street Bakery, we made the green olive loaves and the green olive rolls. There was no salt in that dough because he relied on the salt from the olives. And I really loved how, and that's true for Italian breads where there's a lot of like salty like ingredients or cheese or whatever you're going to put on the bread itself, that they don't salt the bread. And there's something about that that I like. I think if I was going to do more like salt-free baking, I'd start to explore like Tuscan style breads because they don't use salt in their baking.
Yeah, unfortunately for them, right?
Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, I'm sorry. Look, if you have a thing, you have a thing. I don't mean to be a jerk about it. But
you
yeah,
hate
that's a
Tuscan
tough one.
Bread dish.
Detest. I detest it.
That's pretty
funny. I've had it in Tuscany. I'm like, wow. Oh, I have it in America and I hate it. Let me go to Tuscany. I'm sure it's good there. Nope.
Oh, wow.
Do you eat it with salty things or you're just eating it plain?
I've tried it plain. I've tried it with a nice pecorino. I have tried it with olives. And every time I've tried it, I was like, you know what would be nicer? If this bread had flavor.
Oh, no.
You know what I mean? Like,
I had the Absolute Bagels and I was like, whoa, there's hardly any salt in this dough. I was very intrigued by that. I was like, well, there really isn't much salt in this bagel dough. And I'm like, that's very interesting. And sometimes I wonder, so I get a lot of accolades for my stuff, but I'm like, is it because I'm using more salt? Like, am I balancing the salt out? And then, you know, I wonder about that because I use more salt than some bakers do.
Yeah, 2.2. Like usually people top out at 2% and you're at a 2.2. You're a full...
Oh, no,
0.2
no,
that's higher.
2.2 is exactly what Jim Leahy used. And then when I got to Per Se, they were like, no, that's not enough. You need to add more. And they were kept making me add more salt to the point where I'm like, no, absolutely not.
So what's
not.
Your standard? Like, what's your mental go-to per salt percentage?
Somewhere between 2.5 and 3, but not Ooh. Above 3. But then if you have a lot of add-ins in your form, and that's baker's percentage. So say you have a lot of nuts and seeds, then you take the total weight of the dough and you take the percentage at 1.1%. And I can cross compare that with like 2.5% and I take the higher amount.
So on salt, like anything over 3 is going to start messing with the yeast though, right?
Yeah, it does. I remember because I got to experiment a lot with salt and dough at Per Se because everybody, my bosses just wanted so much salt and then the actual dough would start to be affected by the amount of salt. And I remember that the baker before me at Per Se, he's like, well, just say you're going to add more salt, but make it the same. And then tell them that you added more salt and see if they taste it and like it. And if they say, oh, this is good, then don't change the salt. So I think I did try that a couple of times. It worked.
Huh. Well, yes, I'm usually like almost like a flat 2. Maybe I'll try going higher. Like my mental brain works at a flat 2. But
oh,
I'll,
wow.
you know,
I I'll would try, never, but, I almost never use 2. At this point, I think I always assumed based on what I learned at Sullivan that it should be 2.2. And then because I was at Per Se, I was like went up to 2.5. I think Chad's formulas are at least 2.5. They're above 2, I think. I have to go back and look.
I've never had his bread.
I'm only looking at his cookbook recipes. I have had a loaf of his bread once, but I can't remember. I wasn't like, it wasn't like, oh, where's the salt? It just, it felt really balanced to me. Yeah.
I use salted butter though, which I know you'd hate.
Oh no, I That's love the one thing
I refuse to bow to professional
baking, you put it in your... Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow.
I only stock one kind of butter in the house. Booker will not eat unsalted butter, and so I just do everything with salted butter.
Oh, wow. Well, that makes sense. I get the fancy French, like, butter from Brittany, and I the salted butter, and I usually smear that on my toast.
Nice. Well, speaking of that, you have all these recipes, which, you know, I've never tasted one of these. The Queen Aman, which is spelled KOUIGNAMANN.
Yes.
So first of all, in the book, those things are just so freaking pretty. They're so pretty. You want to describe this? It's a newish thing in the U.S.
Yeah,
He's a Frenchy.
It's so good. It's a new trend in the U.S. and it comes from Brittany in France, and it's Breton, and so it translates to butter cake. Butter cake? Because Brittany, part of France, is known for their butter production, and so the Queen Amon in Brittany are not like the trendy things in my cookbook. They're like way more classic, big, large, round ones, and just really full of butter and caramel and sugar. I guess caramel, not caramel in the tradition, like caramelized from the baking, actually. And I liked the Queen Amon that I had been trying around, first in the city here, and then I was in France and I was trying them in France, and I'm like, oh, these are really good. And I think I just started playing around with the recipe.
Yeah, but and the ones you have, it's like folded almost like a dumpling fold in. It's like layered and then folded in, so it has this kind of awesome look.
Yeah.
When you guys get her book, check it out. It's real pretty. It made me want to have one.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I'm sure Nastasia would love to have, because she is a huge fan of this, you do a Concord grape pie. But what a pain in the butt that looks like.
It's true. It's a pain. I'm sorry.
Nastasia, she freezes, Nastasia, yeah, and then cuts each individual Concord grape in half and takes every freaking seed out.
Yeah, wow. I do that. But now you can buy seedless Concords. I think they're called Tomcords.
They're not real. They don't taste the same.
They're not quite the same. You're right. They're not quite the same. But if you were so opposed to doing this with your grapes, but you just had to make a grape slab pie, you could get Mars grapes or Tomcord grapes.
Tomcords, Nastasia would punch me in the face if I handed her a Tomcord, because she is like, Nastasia Lopez is an aficionado of Concord grapes.
Ah, yeah.
And if you live in a place where Concords grow or near it, there is very little that is more intoxicating than walking into a farmer's market when the Concords hit.
Yeah.
And just having that boom, if you don't mind the bees, because bees just like swarm in. Like, in fact, I remember we had a Concord drink at the bar, and we would open the packages from the farmer's market and bees would fly out into the bar.
Oh, wow.
Because
there are a lot of bees. Yeah, the bees love them. At the market, you always have to be careful.
So the freezing is just to keep them in shape while you're cutting them?
Yeah. Have you ever tried to take the seeds out of a Concord grape? Because the skin separates super easily from the middle, but then you can't get the seeds out of the middle. They're like stuck there.
Yeah,
and
the only way
to get them out, really, unless you want to eat the seeds. So I was at Bavo, this was our process. Every evening, while we were waiting for the dessert orders to come in, we had to grab a quart container of grapes and take the seeds out of them. We were making a schiacciata dessert at Bavo. And then when I got to Sullivan Street Bakery, Jim was like, no, no, we're not doing that. He just ate the grape seeds and all.
Well, he's a lunatic.
Yeah.
I find Concord grape seeds to be an unpleasant texture.
I agree. I can't do it. I just don't want it.
Yeah. But, if Nastassia and I ever work in a kitchen environment together again, where we have other people who will do that work for us, maybe we'll try that recipe.
That's a good idea. Definitely.
Yeah. So other things that are interesting, challah. You do a lot of stuff on challah. You have a lot of good braiding pictures. You have some severe braiding skills there.
Yes, I do. Have you seen my hair?
No, not recently.
Yeah,
no.
I usually wear a bun, and it's usually braided. And well, that's sort of a joke. But I guess the braiding and the challah. Yeah, I think that, you know, I have all of these different experiences working in different types of bakeries and restaurants here in New York. And I enjoyed making challah a lot. I like love my recipe. It's a sourdough challah. And I also spent a lot of time teaching bakers how to braid the challah. And, you know, that's, to me, that's the fun part of it.
Yeah, I think I feel like a lot of people are going down a challah hole during this COVID time, so they should get your book and check out the braiding on it.
Yeah,
a couple more things before we get kicked off. First of all, your hot dog buns, you don't use potato starch or flour, like, you know. So like normally when I'm incorporating potato, you use actual cooked potato in your hot dog buns.
Yeah.
And get this, people, she cooks them, then lets them cool down, and then beats them with the skins on. She's using Yukons, but she beats them with the skins on. What's that all about?
What is there? Well, potatoes are starch, right? They just absorb into the dough. And I think, I had learned that a long time ago. I made a sourdough potato loaf at Per Se. And that was the process, is you just, to save time, the mixer is so powerful. You don't try to mash the potatoes. You're just wasting time. Just throw, and I love the skins are so flavorful. Just throw the whole potatoes in and there you go. And I really loved that idea of using whole potatoes in the dough like that. And I think even my gluten-free bread, my trick is to put roasted potatoes in the dough, because it just adds more flavor. It's also starch. It's like vitamin food for your, you know, for your dough. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, and it's pre-cooked. So especially in a gluten-free, it's going to give you the structure that you're not going to have because you've already functionalized the starch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But but this wouldn't work with Burbanks though, because the skin's too thick, right?
You want something with a thin skin.
And do you find that on your hot dog buns that you have to be more careful with the temperature, with convection, with the potato? Do they get browner faster?
With the buns, that's a good question. I would say yes, absolutely. But I think I play around with the convection oven quite a bit with the baking, because I'm always a fan of trying to keep the inside of it as moist as possible. And when you're baking in a convection oven, you've got the air circulating, things can get dried out. So I think I used to bake in the convection oven at 350 for like 15 to 20 minutes. And then recently I've increased the temperature to 375, and then I reduced the baking time because it doesn't take as long. And then it's darker on the outside and just more moist, a little moister on the inside.
All right. Oh, there's a pain. You have a whole section on, speaking of pains in the butt, but a very detailed section on Panettone in the book, including like how to put the skewers, how to turn it upside down.
Yeah.
You have a hilarious part where you, like, in order to get the percentages normal, you literally say, take 220 grams of the dough and throw it away. You're like, you don't have to throw it away. You can make donuts. Just get it out of me. Make it go away. You know what I mean? It's a hilarious section.
That's true. Because I'm glad you're laughing about that, because, you know, I think when my editor saw that, she's like, people won't throw dough away, Melissa. And I think I just do everything in such large batches in the bakery, and this came from the bakery. And I was like trying to make it friendly for home bakers and trying to bring down the percentages, but I needed a certain amount to be like pre-fermented. And finally I'm like, no, we're just going to do it the way I do it in the bakery. And we don't really throw away a huge amount at the bakery. We have this little extra piece. And usually I just give it to my team and they can make staff meal from it, or they have fun with it. They do whatever they want with it. And I was like, well, what am I going to do with this extra piece of dough? If I say throw the dough away in a cookbook, that's sort of sacrilegious. And so I was just trying to figure out what would I want to do with the dough if I had to make staff meal with the extra dough. And I think donut. I like donuts. So
yeah, if you have a fryer going, for sure.
Yeah.
So while we're on Panettone, and it's like it looks like a real deal recipe in the pictures. Everything looks real deal. Where do people get those liners anyway? Just get them on the internet now?
You can get them on the internet. I used to get them at New York Cake and Baking in the city. If it's still open, it is
still open.
Yeah.
They've reopened. And I feel that since they've moved locations, they're not as viciously mean as they used to be.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. It's very different at their new location. And I think
I used to hate the hell out of them.
Yeah, I know. They're not very nice. Yeah, they can be mean. And they're hurt with most people. And I think that they have changed. They probably have a slightly different, maybe the staff is different. But yeah, you can get the Panettone liners there. And you can get all different, they're all different sizes. I think you can get them on Amazon at this point too.
I don't think they have the giant no baby stroller sign anymore. I used to just
buy
it's like, you know, dudes. Anyway.
Yeah. All right.
But like, yeah, so like the turning upside down, otherwise the sucker's going to deflate, right?
Yeah. That's happened to me so many times at home. I'm like, oh, damn it. Like, I just made this beautiful loaf of bread and I just took it out of the oven and I wasn't ready to turn it upside down quite yet. And it already deflated.
And that's one where you use bread flour for the structure, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we have a question that's been floating around for weeks. And that I have not answered. I haven't answered any questions, outside questions this week. But Michael Vahabi wrote in, hey, Dave and Nastasia, I've been making a panettone this year using a stiff starter or a pasta madre. I'm hoping you can shed some light on why the stiff starter, and you wrote about this in the book, which is why I'm pitching this to you, on why the stiff starter is maintained in water and why it's necessary to give the occasional bath and very dilute sugar solution. So far, it's been working, and they have a great rise and low acid. But is all this necessary? It feels like nonsense folk science to me. Thanks, Mike from Toronto. So maybe you can talk about why it's stiff, which you talk about in the book, but then maybe whether some of these other things are actually necessary.
Well, I think it's historical, right? You had a stiff starter, and you were the baker, and you had to do everything, and you're basically sleeping in the room where you're baking in. And so you needed something where you didn't have to feed it so much. So the less water and the more flour you give it, the stiffer it is, the less you actually have to feed it. It made sense from like a workload. It made it easier. But, you know, anytime you have something that's stiffer like that, you have a different flavor profile. You usually have more acetic acid in dough that has more stiffness because of it ferments more slowly. It has more bacteria and it produces acetic acid as a result. And so, but I think I wanted just an approachable, like if you're making it at home, you could go the route of making a really, really traditional panettone. And I wanted to do that, but I also wanted to make it approachable for somebody at home and approachable for me actually. And so approachable for me means not converting, because remember what I said in the beginning, I really abhor when there are like five different starters that you have to maintain. And so there's no way I'm going to have a stiff starter going and a liquid starter going and a whole wheat stiff starter going and a spelt starter going. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have just one starter. But then if I need to convert it to my recipe, and I found that this one works better if you do convert your liquid starter to a stiff starter, that I would convert it. And then I also, you know, I also add yeast to my panettone, commercial yeast. And traditionally it's supposed to be solely raised with the sourdough starter.
Yeah, a lot of people are afraid to do that. And hey, people, it works. Yeast and sourdough works.
Yeah. No, I think I got a question recently because they're like, you can put yeast and sourdough starter and it doesn't kill it. And it's so much of a bakery thing. I think all professional bakers do that because it controls the fermentation. If you have yeast, it ferments it a little faster, depends on the amount of yeast you use, but also that changes the thickness of the crust. So like most bakeries use a combination of the two. And so I use a combination of the two in all of these recipes. I don't think there's one recipe in this book that is just sourdough starter. And I think that was one of the things that was important to me in this book, which is more of a sweet baking book, was to not have it all just, because once you start to talk just about sourdough starter and that's the only thing that's leavening your bread, you have to get more technical about it and be more, not that this book isn't already precise enough, but you need to know what you're doing. And there's more, there is more science to it.
Yeah. I don't know, is that Nastasia dinging me away? So here's,
well, here's, wait, hold on. We do have to go.
All right, here's a piece of writing. When you see writing like this, you know you're dealing with someone.
I got disconnected. I don't know why.
Oh, you got this? Oh. Here's writing that's clearly from a professional. I love this. To me, this is the kind of insight that you hear only from pros. So there's a recipe for a tahini white chocolate chunk, but you'll understand why, but it's like, not long ago, this is the quote, not long ago, it seemed like all of a sudden, many bakers I know started baking with tahini. And this is what it is like in the real professional world. It's like, you're sitting there, you're doing your work,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, this recipe starts popping up all like this ingredient starts popping yep. up all around. It happens in baking. It happens in kitchens. Yeah. But I think the average person at home, they only notice this stuff when it's on the internet. But these things are it's not an internet thing. This has been happening since before people were sharing recipes on the internet. Things just blossom and bloom.
Yep. Yeah. And so true.
You very rarely see people write about it in the way that you wrote about it. And I'm like, that's an experience.
Nice to hear.
I understand.
That's really nice to hear. I'm like, I usually try not to follow trends, and I'm like, but you have to a certain degree. And I'm like, am I a trend follower that I want to use tahini in a cookie recipe? And I think I wanted to be able to rationalize it to myself.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know. It's like when you're doing any of this stuff long enough, you just realize it's so weird how these things like all of a sudden float into existence and then float
out
again.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. I just used ube powder in a shortbread cookie. And I was like, a year ago, I'm like, I am not using ube. I refuse. I'm not making anything ube. And now here, look, I've got an ube cookie and I really like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's funny. So are there any recipes that are going to kick us off soon? Any recipes I haven't brought to attention that you really want people to know about?
That you covered the panettone. I like that you covered the Queen Amon. Those are like really, and I like that you touched on some of the bread recipes too. That's cool. I like that.
And obviously if you look at the cover, you're a babka lover. You're a babka style person. I didn't mention that. But you have several different, not just several different types of babka, seven styles of dough for babka. You're like, it's quite in depth on the babka. So I didn't bring that up.
This
book is not light, by the way. People, listen to this. That's the
the book. You made the book sound. Yeah, it's a heavy book.
Yeah.
Babka, I started making babka before it became trendy, and I wrote a really good recipe for the babka that was featured in Food & Wine magazine in January of 2016, and it was such a well-written recipe that they put the babka on the cover in January on Food & Wine magazine, which is pretty unheard of for a sweet to be on a magazine in January. And it just sort of blossomed into this babka trend. And I had no idea it was going to be a trend, but I had been making these very like Ashkenazi styled babkas, like so bready, not laminated babka for Sidel's. And then everybody loved it so much that I just started making different flavors and chocolate and cinnamon, and then just went from there.
Yeah. All right. Who's you call for unbleached, pastry, whole wheat pastry flour. Who do you use? You use Bob's
in your recipe? I use Bob's. Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm here in New York, I'll use a local whole wheat pastry flour. You can substitute all-purpose flour if you can't find whole wheat pastry flour, because I know that can be a little bit tricky.
All right. Several times in the book, you mentioned that you don't own a blender. Why the hate?
I have a small apartment. There's no hate. It's just, you know, I'll do stuff at work. I have a RoboCoop at work. I have a Vitamix at work. But at home, I just don't have enough space. And I found that I can mostly do everything in a food processor at home.
Mm-hmm. And also, you, like all great pastry chefs I've known, have something against beet sugar. What is it?
Oh.
You call out cane several times.
I don't even know why anymore. I think I used to know why maybe 15 or 20 years ago. There was about the process and the aftertaste. And I'm trying to remember whose book I would have read would have given me the idea that beet sugar was bad.
They used to say it threw a scum during boiling work, right? So they used to say and at the FCI they used to teach this. Maybe that's where
it definitely went. It goes way back to the time that I was living in San Francisco, and I was just like, oh no, I've got to get cane sugar. But now I don't even know why. So I think you're right. It must be part of it.
Well, I've never, thankfully for me, never had to spend like day after day boiling sugar, but that's what they, what they really used to say. It was a kind of a big deal.
Oh, wow.
All right. So, I didn't answer hardly any questions, that came in, and I'm also probably not going to answer that many next week, because next week we have, Joey Sclodani on. Joey wrote a book called, Basic. Now, John, it's Basic Bitching, right? Basic Bitching. Like, now listen, normally people, this is like normally like what we're talking about today, a good bake with Melissa Weller, is more normally our speed, right? But I received Joey's book and I read it. And I have to say the attitude of it is, you check it out beforehand. The attitude of it is he spends his day writing and thinking about like high-end, well-thought-out food, and he wants to come home and just be a basic, whatever. So, which, by the way, I can appreciate that, especially in the COVID times. So, Joey's going to be on the next one, but this week we've had Melissa Weller with her new book, A Good Bake, which was featured by the New York Times, was it not?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Featured by the New York Times. Fantastic. Pick it up at, if you live in New York, get it from Kitchen Arts and Letters. Support those folks. It's a big, hefty book with a nice, what do you call this color anyway? What is this? It's not peach. It's like peach with cream. It's what like color is it?
Pink.
Pink? Yeah.
Pink?
Pretty.
Masculine pink.
Yeah. And a very dark, like sauce covered babka thing on the front. Like a real, like a good bake in the way that the Europeans would say, cooked dark, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a nice, like rich.
Yeah, bien cuit.
There you go, bien cuit.
Yeah.
John, you can say it for me because I can't, I'm not going to do the pronunciation.
Bien cuit.
Yeah, nice. Well, anyway, thanks for coming on. I enjoyed having you. Pick up a good bake.
Thank you so much.
Maybe someday, when this is all over, we can, go have bagels or maybe a Concord grape pie. Stuff.
Yeah, I'd love that, yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thanks. Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.